I'd like to invite you to open your Bibles to the story of Ittai the Gittite. And I'm sure everybody knows where that story is, right? You can open to 2 Samuel 15, and that is where our main text is going to be, Ittai the Gittite. If you didn't know where Ittai's story was found, that's okay. It's a very brief story, and it's a little bit obscure. But I hope that our time in this chapter today will be a time that helps us to appreciate some of the more obscure stories in Scripture and why God has these stories preserved for us. Ittai is only mentioned here in 2 Samuel 15, and there's a brief mention of him later in 2 Samuel 18. But before we get into this story, I just want to sort of set the scene so we know what's going on. The background is a little bit hard to read. This is a story that takes place when David is king, and of course David is the second king of Israel. He has united the tribes at this point, but there's been some really difficult things that have been going on, especially in his personal life. In 2 Samuel 13, one of David's sons named Amnon actually rapes one of his daughters. And the text tells us that David was very angry about that, but he didn't really address it. He didn't really deal with it. And so another one of his sons, Absalom, decided to take vengeance into his own hands. And what Absalom does is he ends up murdering Amnon. And then Absalom becomes a fugitive. He has to be on the lam for 3 years. And so David is upset about all of this. And to make a long story short, Joab is involved in 2 Samuel 14. And Joab sort of engineers the situation to bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. And Absalom returns to Jerusalem, but he doesn't see his father for a couple of years. But by the end of that chapter, he appears before David, and David kisses him. And it seems like a very emotional kind of scene. And you would hope that at this point, maybe that would be the resolution of the story. You know, that was a tough thing that happened, but now everybody has sort of made amends. But I want you to see what happens next in chapter 15. 2 Samuel 15 and verse 1. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Stop there. You know, David has been merciful, David has been gracious, and you would hope, again, that this would be a time of unity, but here comes Absalom seizing upon the opportunity. And I picture him standing here at the gates of Israel and just falling all over himself at the gates of Jerusalem, saying, you know, man, I would make Israel great again, maybe, something like that, I don't know. But he's saying, like, look, if only I was king, things would be better for you. And after a few years of this, Absalom actually goes to Hebron, and he declares himself king at Hebron. And it turns out that he's actually developed quite a following. And so that creates a really uncomfortable situation for David. Now, his son Absalom has declared himself king, but David is the one sitting on the throne. Images of, like, the French Revolution come to mind, you know? It's like, I don't think they had guillotines, but it's not really a safe place for David to be anymore. If Absalom is king, declared himself king, and there are people that are following him. And so our story is set here in 2 Samuel 15, beginning in verse 17. And this is the scene, and this is the setting that David knows he has to get out of Dodge, and so he begins to leave Jerusalem with some of his people. 2 Samuel 15 and verse 17. And the king went out and all the people after him, and they halted at the last house. And all his servants passed by him, and all the Cherethites, and all the Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king. Then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us since I go I know not where? Go back and take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you." But Ittai answered the king, "As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be." And David said to Ittai, "Go then, pass on." So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him, and all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by, and the king crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on toward the wilderness. Okay, if you can just sort of appreciate what's going on, this is like the saddest parade ever, you know? We just read in verse 23 about how all the land is weeping. The rightful king has been dethroned, and he's making his way out of the city, but notice that there's some people with him. It seems like a lot of the Israelites have rejected David in this moment as king, but there are some foreigners who are being loyal. We read about the Cherethites and the Pelethites here, but we also read about some Gittites. Gittites would simply just be people from Gath, and that is how they're described here in this text. You know anything about Gath? Gath was one of five chief cities of the Philistines. There was Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, and Gath. Each one of them had their own kings. You know anything about Israel's relationship with the Philistines? It was strained, to say the least, right? I mean, it seems like if the Israelites are fighting anybody, they're fighting the Philistines. You remember where Goliath was from? Goliath was a Gittite. Goliath was from Gath. But David had actually run to Gath a couple of times, and we've been studying about this on Wednesday nights in our Bible study, that both in 1 Samuel 21 and 1 Samuel 27, that David was running from Saul, and he went to the Philistines, and he spent some time in Gath, and apparently while he was there, he made an impression on some folks who decided that they would be loyal to him. And this story, it just seems like almost this incidental story. You know, David is walking out of the city, and he's on his way out. Everybody's crying, and he stops at the last house, and he notices this guy that's following him, and he says, "Wait a second, who are you?" Like, you know, like we're all crying, and we're all doing our thing. We're leaving the city, but are you sure that you want to come with me? And he gives him four reasons why he should turn back. Did you notice these? Four reasons why Ittai should turn back. He says, first of all, you're a foreigner. Like, I know that we've gotten along for a while. I don't know if you've forgotten this, but you are from Philistia. I'm from Israel. You don't actually have to be loyal to me, is what David reminds Ittai of. The second thing he says is, you're an exile from your home. You know, if you were to leave this fortress of Jerusalem with me and just go out into the wilderness, you're not going to be safe out there. There might not be anywhere for you to go after this. Thirdly, he says, Ittai, you literally got here yesterday. Like, I don't want you getting wrapped up in something that you weren't ready to get wrapped up in. I don't want you to be committing to something that you're not really committed to. I understand if you're not really invested in this whole thing right now. And then fourthly, he says, and by the way, I should tell you, I can't even tell you where we're going. Like, we're going out into the wilderness, but I don't know where all that might lead us and what that's going to be like. So I'll tell you what, Ittai, you just go back. You go back to your people. You'll be better off there. I love Ittai's response. Like, I love this dude. Look at this. In verse 21, he gives David one reason why he wants to stay. Verse 21, Ittai answered the king, "As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be." What Ittai is saying to David is, none of that matters. None of the reasons that you gave me to turn back are good enough reasons to turn back. Because you're the king. You are the one that God has anointed. And so I don't care what it costs. I don't care how hard the path might be. I don't care what it might take. I'm with you no matter what, even if I have to die. You are the Lord's anointed. I wonder what David really felt when he heard this statement from Ittai. You think he was impressed with Ittai's loyalty? It seems like David sort of takes a second. He kind of like takes him aback and he says, well, if that's the way you feel, then let's go, right? But I also wonder if Ittai's response maybe reminded David of anybody. Do you remember who David's great-grandmother was? David's great-grandmother was Ruth. Look back in Ruth chapter 1. Ruth chapter 1, Ruth says a very similar thing to Naomi. In a somewhat similar circumstance where she had every reason to desert Naomi, this is what she says. Or actually, Naomi says in verse 15, Ruth 1:15. See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you. And the text tells us there that when Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said no more. It seems like David sort of takes a cue from Naomi here in 2 Samuel 15. Ittai's statement is so similar to his great-grandmother Ruth's statement. It's a statement of loyalty. It's a statement of commitment. And he says, okay, look, fine. If you know what you're getting into, then let's go. Let's head out. You're with me. Now, it's a really powerful story, and I think that it's really exciting, and it really sort of like makes our hearts soar to see commitment and loyalty like this. But what I want us to see today is that it's not just a good story, but it is an incredibly relevant story for us. At first, this story might just seem sort of incidental or insignificant, but it's extremely relevant for us. And the reason why is because it parallels precisely to Jesus. You know, Jesus was often referred to as the Son of David. If you read the gospel accounts over and over again, people refer to Jesus as the Son of David. What did they mean by that? Well, first of all, it was a reference to Jesus' physical lineage, right? Like if you read the genealogies in Matthew 1 or in Luke 3, which, I mean, more power to you if you really read them and study them. But if you read those, a name's going to pop out. David. Jesus was a descendant of David, right? But even more important than Jesus' physical lineage, I think that this term is a reference to the prophecies about David. If you read the Old Testament prophets, specifically Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, you'll see over and over again how they spoke of the Messiah as David. God made promises, future promises about David that Jesus would fulfill. God even made specific promises to David himself. If you look in 2 Samuel chapter 7, 2 Samuel 7, you'll see how God spoke to David about future promises. Verse 12, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. That was a prophecy about Jesus. And to make this point even stronger, this is what I think is just so cool. Did you notice the details that we were reading as we were reading 2 Samuel 15? That the king crossed the brook Kidron in verse 23. We didn't read it, but as David and his people continue to make their way out of Jerusalem, it says in verse 30 that they went to the Mount of Olives. Isn't that amazing? I mean, the parallels are impossible to miss. You have God's chosen king, the one that God has anointed, rejected by the people, leaving Jerusalem, crossing the Kidron Valley, going to the Mount of Olives, weeping. David walked the exact same path that Jesus would walk on the night he was betrayed 1,000 years later. You see, this story of Ittai and David is not so much about Ittai and David. This story is about us and Jesus. Those are the kinds of lessons that we need to see. So now imagine that you decide that you're going to follow Jesus. You're Ittai in this story, right? And Jesus is, you know, going his way, and he turns to you and he says, "Hey, who are you? Why do you want to follow me?" And maybe even Jesus was to give you some reasons why you shouldn't, some reasons why maybe you should think about turning back. You know, Jesus did that sometimes. Turn over with me to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, this is a very similar story where Jesus says some things a lot like David. In verse 57, somebody speaks up. As they were going along the road, someone said to him, "I will follow you wherever you go." And what does Jesus say? Like, does Jesus say, "That's great, I've been begging people to do this, I'm so glad that you've decided this"? No, he says in verse 58, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Jesus says, "Do you know what you have just said? Do you understand the commitment that you have just made? Because if you don't, I don't want you to try to follow me." Do you remember those four reasons that David gave Ittai? Four reasons why he could turn back? Don't you think maybe Jesus could say some of the same things to us? You know, we just sort of casually decide, "Hey, we're going to follow Jesus. We're going to go to church. We're going to sing some songs. We're going to listen to some sermons. We're going to go to a potluck every now and then," you know? And like, Jesus says, "Hold on. You're a foreigner. You know, like, you are from the earth and I am from heaven. Are you sure that you want to be loyal to me and not to them?" To follow me means to essentially commit treason against your old people, your old nation, right? Like, if you follow me, you're going to be renouncing your old allegiances. You're going to be renouncing your earthly citizenship. Are you ready for that? Or Jesus would say, "You are an exile from your home. That if you leave your old familiar life, you'll have nowhere else to go. If you turn back on your worldly friends, if you turn back on your sinful lifestyle, if you don't go along with the greed or the lust or the selfishness or the pride that you've been going along with, like, if you burn those bridges, where else are you going to go?" Jesus might say something like, "Hey, you came yesterday." Similar to what he means here in Luke chapter 9. Like, "I really don't want you to get wrapped up in something that you haven't actually committed to." Or finally, "I can't even tell you where we're going." Isn't that exactly what he says here in Luke chapter 9? Is, you know, "The animals have places to rest, but I don't. You know, if you're going to follow me, you should know that I'm actually homeless at the moment." But if we know all of that, if we understand all of that, and then we say to Jesus, yeah, "I'm in. I'm going to follow you," how do you think Jesus might react? Now, there's one other story that I think that we need to consider. It's John chapter 6. John chapter 6, we see another time where some disciples leave Jesus. And this is a very sad scene. It's very similar to 2 Samuel 15 also. In John chapter 6, Jesus has been saying some really hard stuff. I mean, he's sort of been at the height of his popularity. He's been feeding people a lot of fish sandwiches, and that, you know, always gets him on people's good side. And he calls them out on that. He says, look, you're not here for the right reasons. You're just here because you want the fish sandwiches. And he says, you know, really what you need to do is you need to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And people are like, I don't know about all that. And in John 6:66, it says, after this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. Now again, I want you to notice this. It's important to see what Jesus does, but it's also important to see what he doesn't do. When Jesus says some hard things and people decide to walk away from him, he doesn't go running after them. He doesn't go begging them, saying like, you took it the wrong way, you know? It's not really so hard. It's like, you can do it, I promise. Like, please come follow me. He doesn't do any of that. He doesn't grovel, he doesn't beg, he doesn't plead. Because Jesus isn't looking for people that aren't really committed to him. He's looking for people that know how hard it will be and who will follow him no matter what. I think some of us need to hear this. I do. I think all of us need to be reminded of this. That Jesus is not wanting us to take our decision to follow him lightly. Following Jesus is not a casual thing. Following Jesus is the most radical, revolutionary choice that you can make. And if you're not up for that, you're not up for it. But there's one reason to stay, and there's one reason that trumps every other reason. And look who speaks up, Peter. John 6 and verse 67. So Jesus says to the 12, do you want to go away as well? Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God. Doesn't that remind you of somebody? Doesn't Peter remind you of Ittai in this story? Jesus, you know, he's fine with people turning back. He's fine with people deciding that they're not up for it, but he really wants the ones that do follow him to know what they're getting into. And Peter says, it doesn't matter how hard it is. It doesn't matter what it takes. It doesn't matter what it costs. You are the king. You are the one that God has anointed. I'm with you no matter what. You know, I'll suggest that this is the reason why we ought to be committed to Jesus. Really, in some sense, the only reason why we would choose to follow Jesus is because we know who only he is. He is the Lord's anointed. He is the Christ. And when we realize that there's no substitute for him, then we'll decide to be with him no matter what it costs or no matter where it leads. You see, Israel might crown their own king in Absalom, but those who really trust God know who the true king is. It's David. The world might crown their own king in Satan or idolatry, but we know who the true king is. It's the Son of God. And it doesn't matter what the rest of Israel does. Those who have faith in God know who the Lord's anointed is. Will we go along with all the people around us, or will we be loyal to the one God has anointed? One last point that I think is worth making. What's fascinating about Ittai's name is that in Hebrew, it means something like companion or with me. Some commentaries have even suggested that it means specifically with God. With God. Does that make you think of another name for Jesus? Jesus was prophesied to be called Emmanuel in Isaiah. Emmanuel means God with us. Now, keep that in mind. last place that we'll look today. Look in John chapter 17. In John 17, Jesus is praying a beautiful prayer. Where? At the Mount of Olives. And he's praying this prayer in John 17 for his disciples, not only for his current living disciples in the first century, but also for future disciples. Don't miss this. Jesus is praying for us in this text. And look at what he says in John 17 in verse 24. At the end of this beautiful prayer, John 17, 24, Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am, to see my glory that you have given me, because you loved me before the foundation of the world. Emmanuel prays for us to be Ittai. God with us prays for us to be with God. Isn't that awesome? Like, out of all of the things Jesus prays for, that is the final thing. That is the crown jewel of this amazing, beautiful prayer. And so to be with Jesus means that we follow wherever he leads. The hard thing about that is we don't know where that path will take us sometimes. We don't know if it will lead us through pain or sacrifice or discomfort, through service, through shame. But the good thing about following Jesus is we know where that path ends, don't we? I've always appreciated that in Revelation 14, when John sees the people of God in heaven, he describes them this way. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed. And so to be with Jesus means that one day we'll rest before the throne. And the question that we need to think about now is, will any sacrifice that we make now seem too great then? You see, the gospel is all about how God has gone to unimaginable lengths so that we could be with him. And it presses the question on us, how badly do we want to be with God? We love because he first loved us. Ultimately, we want to be with the King because he's the King, and we know that. But we also want to be with the King because we know just how much the King wants to be with us. I know that lesson is pretty general, but I think it's a very important principle for us. And I hope that it's encouraged all of us to think about the commitment that we've made to Jesus. That if there's anything that Jesus could say that could talk us out of following him, then our faith and our loyalty isn't quite where it needs to be yet. We need to keep growing in commitment to him. But if there's somebody here that is thinking about becoming a disciple of Jesus, I want to tell you it's the best decision you'll ever make. I want to tell you that there is no other way that makes sense to live. But if you're not willing to really commit to it, get that sorted out before you do. But if you believe that Jesus is the King, if you believe that Jesus is God's anointed, that he is the Son of God, that he died for your sins and he rose again, and you're willing to pledge allegiance to him every day of your life, then you're ready to be buried with him in baptism. If there's somebody here that wants to make that commitment, or if there's anybody here that needs the prayers of this church, wants to ask for help, ask for the prayers for some spiritual purpose, this is a time that the church has decided to make an invitation. The invitation is the Lord's, but we join in inviting you. And if we can help you make your life right with God in any way, now's the time to come to the front and let us know how while we stand and sing.